Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
We're in studio with Kevin on Vermont Viewpoint, and we're going to go right to it because it's the day after a massive election that's going to tell us a lot about our country and about the state of Vermont. And we're going to go right to a history-making guest, the Congresswoman-elect from Vermont, Becca Ballant. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Good morning, and hopefully you can hear me grinning ear to ear.
So it's so hard to know where to start, but you must be exhausted, obviously, and I think a lot of people are bleary-eyed. We listened to your victory speech, but let's just take it from the top headline. You have made history as the Vermont as the first woman to represent Vermont in the United States Congress. What is the significance of that, and how does that make you feel?
Well, I just feel such deep, deep pride that I'm going to be able to represent our state. I love this state so much. I love my community, and be the first woman in Congress is personally important to me when I think about how much I wanted to be in politics as a little girl and just didn't see a path for myself. And now, you know, having parents come up to me at events and meet and greets and have me meet their children, I think it's giving people a sense of hope that they can perhaps do things that they didn't think they would be possible for them to do. And, you know, on the macro, we know policy is better when you have multiple perspectives in the room. And so we've been very, very well served by our congressmen and senators. They've done a tremendous job. I do feel like we've had the best congressional delegation for years. But I know that when you have women in the room crafting policy, you get a better outcome.
You are taking the place of Peter Welch, the Democrat, who is in turn taking the place of Senator Leahy, who is retired. 158,000 people voted for you. That's a lot. And yet it is very possible that you – it's hard to ask you to think ahead, but it's very possible you're going to go to Washington, D.C. and serve in the minority with a Republican speaker. And it's – in the dark of night, it's sometimes you might think to yourself, oh, I'm going to have the worst office, the worst committee, and I'll have no power at all. How do you think about that going ahead?
Well, you know, here's the way I've been thinking about it, is that regardless of whether we are able to eke out a slim majority or if we are in the minority, the work is the same. You know, we have a democracy that we need to fight to save. We've got working families across Vermont who are struggling with, you know, bread and butter issues like housing and childcare and, you know, the mental health crisis. And so I can see how, looking at the numbers, someone could feel quite, discouraged and cynical. For me, it's an amazing opportunity because I've gotten to know a number of the, colleagues who are going to be coming in with me in this freshman class. And I'm very excited about what they're, bringing to Congress. Many of them, like me, have come up through state legislatures. They believe in government. And so I'm going to go with deep curiosity and a willingness to work with anyone who's willing to work with me in good faith, because it's just too important. I can't let the dark part of it get me down.
You said in your victory speech that Vermont is a place where kindness and integrity and courage matter, where the daughter of an immigrant dad and a working class mom can be the first woman and the first gay person to represent Vermont in the U.S. House. I don't know if you wrote that down or it came off the top of your head, but what's going on there?
So much is going on there. You know, my parents were in the audience last night, and they just are so tickled. There's no other word I can come up with. Just so tickled and so proud of me. And we didn't know anyone in politics. We are not a family that comes from privilege and power. And when I first even started to run for office in the state Senate, my dad was really nervous about it, nervous about me being so public as a gay woman. And he was concerned about what kind of anger and vitriol I might get. And so to see that Vermonters really wanted to hear a message of courage and of hope. And we ran a very joyful campaign. And a lot of people said to us, you know, you're not going to be able to win on that. Right. This is a time of, you know, a lot of grievance politics, a lot of anger. And they said, I just don't think people are going to show up for that. And, we, excuse me. Sorry, Kevin. I got a little, the early morning voice there.
Oh, understood.
We were hearing from Vermonters, really. And I think I spoke to this in my speech as well. We are hearing from Vermonters across the state. There's like, we want something different. We want to be able to communicate within our communities to our neighbors, even if we disagree. And that's something that I've always felt strongly about, both as a teacher and then in my work in the state Senate, is not demonizing each other, not drawing strong, you know, lines, between me and my, you know, my colleagues, even if we disagree. And I think Vermonters are reflective of the nation as a whole. I think people are exhausted. I think they want a different kind of politics, but they don't know how to get there. And I'm hoping to be able to be leading a different kind of national conversation about how we treat each other. Because if we can keep going like this, we keep tearing each other apart, I don't see how we're going to save the democracy. So that's really important to me.
Excuse me. You made history in some other ways too. We talked on the air last night about you being the first woman to represent Vermont in Congress, but we did not talk about the fact that you are the first female gay person to go to Congress. And it was almost like we had reached a point, and I talked to Mike Pichak about this too. Where we're not talking about this anymore. And some people think that's a good thing. Some people think we should keep talking about it. And I can't let this go without pointing out that you stand on the shoulders of so many who went before. I'm thinking of Madeline Kunin, but I'm also thinking about a woman who we can't have on the show because she is a federal judge, Beth Robinson, who began at county fairs with card tables talking about same-sex marriage and loving your neighbor. And that law passed in 2009, which I was a part of. And here we are so recently after that landmark legislation. We don't even know the sexual orientation of a guy like Mike Pichak or Becca Ballant, and nor do we care. And I just hope you'll talk about that a little.
Happy to. You know what's been so interesting watching this campaign unfold, you know, we got a lot of advice from folks. They did not think that I should be so candid about being gay.
Right.
There are definitely people who didn't want us to have my wife in my commercials. And I had said from the beginning, I got to run as myself through and through. That's what people want and need. And so there was definitely a lot of concern from our surrogates and our supporters that they didn't know if Vermont was ready to elect an openly gay person statewide. And I think because of the way we ran the campaign, which was a lot of old style retail politics, I went out and met thousands of Vermonters face to face in much the same way that the marriage equality movement really took hold in Vermont, was talking neighbor to neighbor. And so, yes, I think in the end, for those folks within the LGBTQ community, it was momentous. It was important. And for other folks, they just felt like I was the best person for the job, and that it didn't matter that I was going to be the first, you know, openly gay person to serve. And I always say openly gay because we just don't know who else has served our state in the past who didn't feel like he or she could be open about their identity. So I think we've come a long way, and I think it's a tremendous moment, not just for me and my campaign, but for Vermont as a whole.
So you are the Congresswoman elect.
Yeah, can you believe it? That's crazy.
You live in Brattleboro.
Yes.
Here's the big question of the day, and then I think we should let you go and get a drink of water.
Thanks, Kevin.
Do you fly out of Albany to D.C., or do you fly out of Bradley Airfield in Hartford, Connecticut? And you have children, you are married.
Yes.
How do you manage flying back and forth to Washington, D.C. with dealing with family and responsibilities at home? And going to D.C., that's going to change your life. How are you going to handle it?
Well, in some ways it will, in some ways it won't. Because if, you know, when you live in Brattleboro and have to drive 2 hours to Montpelier each week, it is, in some ways, it's the same commute, because I would zip down to Hartford and fly down to D.C. It's a very short flight. And my family has gotten used to the routine of me being, you know, home for 3 days and away for 4 days during the session. And it's going to be similar. And there'll certainly be crunch time, but my kids are 12 and almost 15. My wife has a job she really enjoys. And we met as a family during the primary when it looked like I might win the primary, to have a serious conversation about what we wanted to do as a family. And they want to stay at their school, and my wife wants to stay in her job, and I'll be doing a different kind of commute. But Congress has changed a lot in the last 10 years, and most members now, even the ones in California, fly home every weekend to be with their families and to be with their constituents. And there's actually something that Bernie brought up with me in some of our first conversations during the primary, and he said, you know, it's really important that you get back to Vermont on the regular. And I said, well, I'm planning to be home every weekend. And he said, that's good. That's good. That's what we need. So I know there's going to be, you know, challenging moments for me and my family, but we're a team. We've always said that we could not do it unless we were united as a team. And we all understood that it's not just a sacrifice for the person running, it's a sacrifice for the family. And they've been able to balance that with the excitement. They're so proud of their mom. They're so proud of their mom. And that just fills me with so much love and joy for them, and hope and promise for the nation. You know, I'm just a regular person, and I'm about to go to Congress to represent Vermont, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, first of all, congratulations. Second of all, open invitation to appear on the show whenever you desire. The pride of Smith College, Farm and Wilderness, and Brattleboro, Vermont, and school kids everywhere who are probably grown up by now, but they're probably reading the newspaper or looking at you online and saying, wow, that was my elementary school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So it's happening. So congratulations, yes. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. Have a great day.
Okay, Becca. That's Becca Ballant. I'm Kevin Ellis. It's Vermont Viewpoint. You're listening to WDEV. We're back. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis. And in studio, we have a new guest, Myers Mermel of Manchester, Vermont, Republican candidate for United States Senate. He lost a primary. And he's in studio. He lost the primary to Christina Nolan. But he brings a valuable voice.
Gerald Malloy.
And yeah, to Malloy, that's right.
He was the victor.
But he brings a valuable voice to this this discussion. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Long drive from Manchester.
Beautiful drive as always. But I have to say I was very happy to hear Miss Ballant. She sounds so enthused and really gratified. She ran a very good campaign. And I'm looking forward to having her as our congresswoman and the historic first that she's achieved, first as a woman and then first openly gay woman, as you noted, I think are really wonderful things. And all of us Americans root for the underdog, right? And women and gay people have been the underdogs. So it's nice to see Vermont in its way stand up for the underdog.
Okay.
And,
so,
and actually her victory, looking on a national level, like her victory is a is the shining star of the progressive election, really, because progressives didn't do that well outside of Vermont.
So let's look at – well, before we go to the national board,
right,
let's go up in Vermont a little bit and talk about Peter Welch.
Yes.
Resounding victory. Incumbents in Vermont are strong. It's very difficult. Malloy, despite his street signs and yard signs, which I thought were, arresting, they caught my attention. He didn't break through. But Peter Welch has been on the scene forever. Mm-hmm. People are comfortable with him. He's been in the legislature. He was president of the Senate. What do you make of that race? And what do you make of Welch replacing Patrick Leahy in the United States Senate at the age of 79?
Right. Well, Mr. Welch has served Vermont capably. But I think if we step back for a moment and look – I mean, and he did have the power of the incumbency going into the contest. But he also had broad support across the state, and he did campaign very hard. He had a lot of endorsements. He had raised a large war chest, and he focused on issues that Vermonters wanted. And unfortunately, the Republicans fielded candidates that, you know, were pushing positions that were not in favor with Vermonters on the social side, right? A 50-state ban on abortion was not in favor with Vermonters. Other restrictive things were not in favor with Vermonters. So I think Peter Welch really captured the spirit of the times and, you know, will move forward. And like all Vermonters, I look forward to seeing him working in the Senate. There were ideas that I brought up in the campaign, like the fabrication facility that's being built in Albany, $14 billion, the CHIPS Act. I was the only candidate to bring up the CHIPS Act, but I was glad to see now Senator Welch pick that up. And I think Vermont should have a $6 to $8 billion fabrication facility, both in the north and south. It'd be a tremendous benefit to Burlington and Rutland.
So you'd bring up the quality of candidate. So let's now move to the national map.
Right.
And we were talking about this off the air. I said if Trump had not endorsed candidates that are very right-wing, that I thought that Republicans could have really made gains nationally, taken over the House, taken over the Senate in big ways. But you pushed back on that. I mean, I talked about Herschel Walker.
Pushed back.
Well, didn't you say
I'm a pushover. What are you talking about?
Talk about the quality of Republican candidates.
Yeah, but let's talk nationally, right? It's Republican Christmas today.
Okay.
Christmas early, right? We didn't get the mini bike, but we got the BB gun and a football. Right. We increased our standing in the House by 10 seats. Right. So now we'll have a majority of 10 seats in the House. And it looks like if things, you know, break the way they should in Nevada and Georgia, that we'll probably have, you know, a tie in the Senate and we'll be back to 50-50 where we were before.
Right.
So it's actually not a loss for the Republicans. It's a pretty good day for the Republicans. And the Republicans will now be able to slow spending and to, slow some of these executive orders, hopefully re-energize energy. But I think one of the takeaway, but, you know, there were some stunning losses, right? We were able to pick up Nevada, or we should pick up Nevada on the Senate side, but we lost in the Fetterman-Oz race.
Right.
You know, two things were not on the ballot. Donald Trump was not on the ballot, and democracy's not on the ballot, right? Thank you, God, our constitutional republic has survived, right? It was never in jeopardy, right? So this idea that democracy is on the ballot just wasn't true. But I think what was a fact was interesting to see is that, you know, the left and the right were voting on very different topics.
Right.
Whereas the right was motivated by crime and the economy, it was really abortion and climate that motivated the left. And they didn't seem to cross over. There was some crossover, but you didn't see it. I will say on the state level, right, the Republicans did not do as well as they did nationally. It looks like we're going to have about seven. We had seven senators before. We're going to have seven senators now. But it looks like we're going to be down on the House rep side. And we lost some strong Republicans like Vicky Strong, for instance, and Sally Aiken. I mean, we lost some really strong stalwarts in the party.
Well, I noticed, I could not help but notice, and I mentioned this on the air last night, that Phil Scott, and we need to talk about him, he had his own victory party. And the Republican Party had its own party over here, and never the twain shall meet. What's the future of the Republican Party, given the numbers of last night in Vermont?
Well, I mean, what you haven't brought up is Prop 22. And so the base, right, the Republican base was very much against Prop 22, but as I had seen through polling through the summer, and as I discovered, which I think most of the Republican Party should know, is that half of the Republican base is pro-choice.
Yeah.
So that's why this constitutional amendment carried. And over the summer, I never met Governor Scott. Governor Scott did not participate in Republican Party activities. And I really have to say, I'm not sure the Republican Party did a very good job. It's been rife with conflicts. And, you know, the fact that they're losing seats like they did today is not a good thing. And they didn't show up with statewide candidates. They just didn't field, you know, in some of these races. And they and some of their choices are just hard to believe. And whether they can come to grips with it and deal with their conflicts, I don't know. It doesn't look like it.
I do not have the numbers in front of me on the Phil Scott race, but an enormous victory.
70%, right?
The Vermont tradition is that governors running for a fourth term barely eke it out,
Jim
Douglas, Howard Dean, because people are tired of them. That did not happen here. This guy is really popular.
Well, yes, and I know this may not come across well to my Republican brethren, but I do think Governor Scott taught a master class to the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And he showed that, you know, Vermont wants fiscal conservative but social liberal. I mean, he's not a social moderate. He's a social liberal. And that works in Vermont. And certainly he's with us on some of the most important things and has been over the years. And so I was never against Governor Scott. I was a supporter of him, but I've been surprised that Republicans have turned against him, and I think we need to really – we need to reverse that trend. We need to champion Governor Scott.
In 30 seconds, who do you blame for that?
Blame.
That's right.
Who's to blame?
We're at war here.
Yeah, well, right? It's not church and it's not politics if you don't have an enemy. So
but that's Fisher in the Republican Party. We'll come back and talk about that after the break. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin Ellis. Our guest is Miles Mermel. You're listening to WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
We're back. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin. We're going to go right to it. Our guest is David Zuckerman, the Lieutenant Governor-elect of Vermont. He regains his seat as Lieutenant Governor of Vermont by a 51-41 margin, according to the latest results. David Zuckerman, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate being here, and good to be with you.
How are you? Exhausted?
I'm pretty exhausted. I did stay up a little later looking at the national scene and then had to get up around 6 to let the hens out and feed and unfreeze their water. So it's a bit of a morning. Looking forward to a nap this afternoon.
So we just got off the phone with Becca Ballant, of course, who made history.
Tremendous.
Tremendous, right? You're making history in a bit of a different way. You were the lieutenant governor for two terms. You were in the House. You were in the Senate. You ran for governor. You are now back. People ask you, why did you do this? I have my answer, but tell us, why run for this office again? What made you do it?
Well, actually, Vermonters encouraged me to do it. My family encouraged me to do it because they felt like there needed to be a fairly small-p progressive voice to really push the envelope on economic injustice issues and climate. And as I farm every day, you know, a few days ago, what was it, 75, 80 degrees in parts of Vermont, I said, you know, it feels good on our skin, but it's burning our soul. You know, we have a ski worldwide ski tournament in Killington in 3 weeks. How are we going to have enough snow? They're going to make it, but it's going to be tight. We have a maple industry that is the culture of Vermont. It's our spring, you know, community gathering, sugaring, and it's our fall foliage. What's going to happen in 50 years? So people said, you know, they felt badly what happened 2 years ago. The timing was bad with COVID, but they wanted me back in office. And I said, I'll give it a shot, see what happens.
Has Joe Benning called you, by the way? Your opponent, Joe Benning, from Lindenville, did not go to the Republican so-called victory party. He stayed home and questions your ability to work with the governor. That's no secret. You've talked about that yourself. Have you talked to Benning?
We did not get a chance to talk. I did message him last night as the evening was moving on, and I thought the situation was becoming clear, and folks in Burlington at the party rally as well as the media were kind of wondering when I was going to make a statement. So I messaged him to check in. He said he wasn't ready to concede, but I asked him for kind of what was the path at that point with only 30% of the vote left, and I was up by nearly 10%. So I did move forward. He did then text me this morning saying, congratulations, you win. But we've not had a chance to chat yet. I do look forward to talking with him. He's a good, reasonable guy. We've worked well together and respect each other quite a bit. And so I look forward to talking to him, but we did not have a chance yet to do that.
So you look forward to a Vermont Senate that looks like it's going to stay, as the numbers go, fairly the same. 23 Democrats and independents to 7 Republicans, if I have that right, overwhelming superiority. You preside over the Senate. You've done it before. Shouldn't come as any discomfort for you. As you look ahead to the next 2 years, what's the challenge in front of you that you want to tackle?
Well, I think it's interesting. You lay out the situation in the Senate quite clearly, and I suspect earlier you talked about the House, which was really where the monumental shift was. You know, going from about 99 Democrats and progressives together to 109 Democrats and progressives. And I think that's going to change some of the dynamic with respect to the combined legislature and the governor. You know, the Senate has some new folks. Some of them are from the House, really solid individuals. There's some other new folks from around the state that bring a lot to the table. And there's some really good, sage, wise folks who have been there for a long time. So I think it's a good mix. I think they get a good feel for kind of the broader landscape with the larger districts that they've got. But I think the issues that the Senate, you know, overrode the governor on the last biennium, but the House couldn't quite do it, those are going to come back up, you know, from climate issues to wage issues and family issues. And I think that's really the pulse of the state right now is housing and general economic stability for folks around wages and child care. And the climate. So I think that'll probably be a lot of the agenda, but I'd look to the senators for the leadership on the agenda day to day while I help guide that across the state.
So on the personal front, you are a farmer and you're not just a show farmer. You're at the farmer's market. You're in the fields. You're in the barn. This is a difficult balance to strike. Being father, husband, farmer, lieutenant governor. I've seen you talk about this, but it's difficult, as well, all Vermonters can attest, right? Most Vermonters
Absolutely.
Do multiple things. It's not that you're heroic by any means, but it's just hard, especially in February when you're up in the dark. Can you talk to us about that, about how you balance these priorities?
Well, it is a difficult balance, and over time, as the farm has gotten bigger, thankfully we've been able to have more help on the farm, because as you get larger you need that help, and we've got some really great experienced folks working on the farm. My spouse carries a huge load And, you know, we're going to talk about it over the next couple of months. Will we be farming at the same scale or continuing to farm over the next couple of years? Because I do think my role as lieutenant governor is going to grow, not just doing the official duties of the job and what I used to do with traveling the state on occasion to visit with folks, but really trying to travel the state more and hear people and be an ambassador for what's going on in the state house and continue to build citizen involvement in our process, which thankfully in Vermont is pretty robust, but it's amazing how many people I talk to who just still feel like they don't have a voice or they don't know how to reach out to their legislator. And it's not for a lack of that opportunity, but sometimes they just haven't been connected. So it is a hard balance. And as I get older, as I'm sure many people know, as we get older, it gets a little harder to do 16 and 18 hour days. And so we are going to have to make some adjustments on the farm in order to really take advantage of the opportunities that the Lieutenant Governor's office offers.
Okay, and here's the big question that nobody wants me to ask, but I said it to Mark Johnson off the air last night. This positions you to be next in line if Phil Scott decides not to seek a fifth term. It positions you as, if not the front runner, a front runner to be governor of this state.
Is there a question there? You made a good statement, but
are you
a question for me to answer?
Are you or are you not the front runner for an open seat if as governor if Phil Scott decides not to run for re-election in 2 years?
Well, you know, I'm not going to totally prognosticate. I would say clearly I am better known than most of the other potential candidates. But, you know, I know T.J. Donovan has stepped aside, but he is well known. We've got a slew of great statewide office holders that are coming in right now who I think are going to do a fantastic job. So, you know, let's focus. You know, we're less than 24 hours out of the results from this election. I think Vermonters are excited about, or I don't know if excited is the right word, but would like to see us get the job done for the time being. And, you know, elections just get so long. I've actually encouraged a lot of people to stop starting their races a year and a half before an election because it just means where's the work getting done. So I appreciate the sentiment. I think it does position me well, but I think Vermonters will have a lot of good options in the future.
I'm looking at some numbers from the folks over at Emerge Vermont. The number of women in the legislature, all the ballots not being counted, but it looks like the percentage of women in the legislature is now up to 45% from about 40. And women of color, a dramatic increase to 5. That, you know, the Speaker of the House is a woman. It's Becca Ballen is now the member of Congress. It's not to say that women have taken over, but they are now at the table in an equal way. And boy, who knew that we would see that 10 years ago, right?
Well, sure. I mean, it has been building, and I think that's a good thing. You know, we've had women leadership with Speaker Johnson before Speaker Kowinski. We've had chairs of, I think, all of the money committees and a lot of other important committees that have been women, and they've done a great job, and I think it's really important to acknowledge the work and the job and the skills, frankly, more than gender, because we don't want to pigeonhole folks that they just got that because they're women. They got those jobs because they're really good at those jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are continuing to grow that statewide. We've got two women, Sarah Goldman-Hansis and Charity, that just got elected as well. And then you've got Mike and Phil and Doug and me, and why am I not remembering the sixth one? But in any case, you know, yeah, I think there's a lot of things to be happy about last night. And Vermont set a standard and a tone, not just with who we elected, but also with how we carry out these elections compared to a lot of other states. And I think Vermonters have a lot to be proud of.
We have to take a break. I know you're A, exhausted, B, you've got work to do on the farm, but and probably calls to make.
I'm available.
Okay. Well, then if you could stick with us till after the break, I'd love to talk about the national map and what that means for the country and all sorts of other political issues. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. Our guest is David Zuckerman, the new lieutenant governor-elect for the state of Vermont, and you're listening to WDEV. We're back. It's Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Kevin. Our guest is Lieutenant Governor-elect David Zuckerman, back for Zuckerman 2.0. David, the expected red wave did not happen nationally.
Yep.
It's still hanging in the balance. As I look at the map, the Republicans could still take over the United States Senate. I'm gonna predict that they are gonna take over the House. But what does this mean for it's a real mixed message around candidates like Herschel Walker and Dr. Oz. Were they the right candidates to put up? Should there have been more moderate Republican candidates? What's the role of Trump? As you look at the national map last night and this morning, what's your reaction?
Well, my biggest reaction is a sigh of relief that the red wave did not come out the way that it was starting to build over the last few weeks. I certainly was hoping for a little bit more gain in the Senate. If they can hold it, that's great. If they can maybe gain a seat, that would be even better. But it looks like it's about even, and maybe it's going to be a Warnock runoff to see if they pick up a seat or stay even. In the House, I don't have the detail level that much yet, but what I'm hearing on the radio and seeing in the news is that a lot of seats that were presumed maybe to be flipping to the Republicans, it's going to be fewer than that. So they're going to have a pretty small majority, but I do think you're right that they're going to take the majority, and that's going to cause a lot of gridlock. But I think some of those Republicans who end up with really close races are going to have to think about that, because in presidential year, when turnout goes up, that might mean some of those races actually turn the other way, and so they may have to think about whether they're going to be obstructionists or going to be collaborators.
Do you think it's possible that there's a scenario here where the Republican Party could turn into a collaborative party? That's a significant statement.
I don't think they're going to be a collaborative party. No way. I think the leadership is too beholden to the myths and the lies because their constituents are, which is unfortunate, because I think those are decent people struggling, and they're looking for reasons to, why has the world shifted for them? But it's not because of fraudulent elections. And it's not because of some of the places they're placing the blame. But I do think in certain districts, if there's 5 or 10 of them that end up in districts that were really close races, and those 5 or 10 are the margin of the majority or not, they'll get tremendous pressure from their colleagues, but they're also going to get a lot of pressure looking forward at the next election, where turnout will go up. And if they're obstructionists, sometimes in the past when they've blocked everything, they've lost a lot of seats, and so I think they're going to be hopefully wiser for that.
Take us in. You've been inside these rooms in Montpelier, electing leaders. Take us inside, if you would, the room where the Republican leader in the House in Washington, Kevin McCarthy, is now the dog that has caught the car, and he wants to be Speaker of the House. And there's lots of very, very right-wing people in the House, election deniers, who don't want him to be Speaker. And he's going to have to make a deal with Marjorie Taylor Greene in order to be Speaker of the House. Take us inside that room, if you just guess for us.
All right. Well, I'll do my best. It's not my expertise, but I think he's clearly positioned to be the Speaker from his past role. Yes, she is a bright light for the party and kind of a media, a light for bugs. Everybody goes to her. And I think that's something that, frankly, the Democrats and the left built up just as much as the Republicans did. And I think that's a mistake on our part. But, I think in the end, when the rumor is that a lot of these folks do know outside of the Taylor Greens, but I think a fair number of House members and a number of the senators do know that the elections are clean and fair. They do know that the Trump cult is misguided. You know, I think in the end they find a way to keep him in leadership where they also recognize that if some of their folks vote occasionally for a bipartisan solution, that they're actually more likely to stay in the majority in 2 years than lose it. Yeah. And if they're all going to get chairs and they're all going to get leadership positions and McCarthy's going to be at the helm, he doesn't want to be a one-term speaker.
Yeah.
And so if he can talk to them about that reality, well enough to convince them that, you know, they got to let some folks vote the other way. And I would argue a similar parallel in Vermont. You know, if as speaker or as the leadership of the Senate says every single time, every single member of the party has to vote 100% in lockstep, that puts some of the folks in a real bind back in their, you know, swing districts. And I think that's one of the advantages that Speaker Kowinski just got, which is now there's 109 Democrats and progressives. Even to override the governor, you can say, you know what, in your district, if you have to vote no on the bill initially, that's okay, and possibly even on the override. And that way, not everybody gets painted as exactly the same.
That is the under-discussed story of the day so far, is what happened in the Vermont House. 109, that's a lot.
Huge. I think it's a really telling piece that I think also reflects, interestingly enough, on the governor's race, and I'll tell you why. You know, about half of Vermont still didn't even really know who Brenda was,
right,
or is. And so he won overwhelmingly, no doubt. I think people are very comfortable with him. They're extraordinarily familiar with him. He was a steady hand through COVID. But if you actually ask people about the issues, well, they just voted back in everybody that I know of that voted to override him on minimum wage, on the climate bill. You know, some of these things lost by just two or three votes in the override. And they added more in those districts where there were people that maybe voted with the governor on the overrides. So I think his vote is not – it's certainly a victory. I don't want to take that away from him, and
sure,
it's a solid victory. I don't think it's an overwhelming mandate, because if it was, he would have had some coattails. My own opponent tried to really pick up on that coattail theme, and frankly – if he was really working out there to make sure he was going to have an override, veto-proof minority, that just didn't materialize.
Right. It is amazing, Phil Scott's popularity. It speaks volumes to him as a professional politician.
I think as a person, too.
Yeah,
you know,
as a person.
A very decent person.
Yeah, and I have been saying for a couple of years now, God, when is he going to – why bother? Why put yourself through the work and the heartache? I mean, it's a really hard job. But he remains incredibly popular in a party that is very divided. They didn't even have a victory party together. Joe Benning didn't even go to the Republican victory party, and Phil didn't either. He had his own party.
Well, absolutely. And you look at a lot of us thought Orange County was going to be a close Senate race, and Mark McDonald walked away with it. And that's a county that, you know, when you and I remember 20 years ago, that was a pretty darn conservative county. And now I think two of the three or odd House seats are Democrats, and Mark McDonald, you know, won walking away. It's an extremely divided party. I think it's important for people to recognize that some of the national Republican energy does exist in Vermont. I was at a poll yesterday talking to someone in Jitney County who's running as a Republican, and suddenly she was talking about how the Russians were right to go into Ukraine because they were destroying biomedical labs and they were thwarting child pedophilia stuff that Biden, you know, that's why Biden supports Ukraine. And I just thought, wow, you know, this universe across the country is infiltrating Vermont, you know, John Klar, some of these other candidates, statewide candidates, and that was pretty soundly rejected by Vermonters.
There was
a lot of decent Vermonters on all sides of the aisle.
Yeah, the Orange County Senate race really surprised me. I thought that was going to be, just judging by yard signs alone, I thought it was going to be closer, and it's a lesson to all of us pundits to wait for the election results, because yard signs do not an election make.
So. Well, no. I mean, I actually talked to a couple folks from the Malloy team when I was at the last polling place. And I said, you know, I just I appreciate Gerald Malloy. I met him. He's been a decent guy to talk with. But I don't know if he really understands some of the ethic in Vermont that we all try. And, you know, each of us as volunteers that don't do what we want, but I try to impress, and I think a lot of others do, that if someone puts a lawn sign out, you don't block it by 6 inches on either side. You kind of respect that they got, you know, that turf. And we all try to clean up our lawn signs. And I just ask them to maybe pass that on to him, because there are more Malloy signs than I think I've ever seen on any campaign. And turns out they're both from Massachusetts. And I wonder how many of his team and volunteers are even in Vermont, in which case, you know, I hope he can get that stuff cleaned up. Because we do have a good ethic here. And but some of the candidates, you know, you look statewide, they barely had a field to put on the field.
David Zuckerman, congratulations. Welcome to come on the show anytime. Your insight into politics nationally and in Vermont is valuable to all of us. Good luck on the farm. Good luck as Lieutenant Governor-elect. And we'll be talking to you down the road. Thank you.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. It'd be fun to come on again. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, take care. You're listening to Vermont Viewpoint. Our next guest is going to be Charity Clark, the Attorney General-elect. You're listening to WDEV. We're back. We're talking about the elections on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Kevin Ellis is your host and our guest. Another history maker is Charity Clark, the Attorney General-elect of the state of Vermont. Welcome, Charity Clark, to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So we started the day out with Becca Ballant, history maker number one. We just got off with David Zuckerman, the new new lieutenant governor elect. And now we are talking to the woman who Vermonters have made the first female elected attorney general in the state's history. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do.
How does it feel?
It feels great. It feels, you know, I'm especially in this moment thinking of the women who work at the Attorney General's office, as I did for 8 years, who have never had the experience of having Vermonters select a woman to lead them, and how that must feel to know that a woman can achieve, you know, really the pinnacle of being a lawyer in our state, is the, you know, the most powerful lawyer in our state is the Attorney General. And I think and I've of course heard from many of them who are just very enthusiastic about this turn of events.
You came out of nowhere in some ways. You were the chief of staff. You've been a lawyer for a long time. You were the chief of staff to Attorney General T.J. Donovan. And then virtually overnight, because he made a surprise decision to resign and take a job in the private sector, you were faced with the decision about whether to run for attorney general, and you did so. Take us back. We've talked about this on the show before, but take us back to that day when you said, you know what, I'm going to do this.
You know, I think I've told you, Kevin, about this, that there is a conference room in the Attorney General's office that has portraits of all of the former attorneys general displayed, and it's 26 men and no women. And it's very jarring, and it really makes a visual statement. When I became chief of staff, I really did start thinking about what was next for me and what was next for the Attorney General's, you know, leadership. And that just the visual, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. And the words there were, hey, Charity, maybe you should run for attorney general.
You said in an interview Tuesday that your first order of business would be some in the weeds process of reacquainting yourself with the office's current staff and casework. As you look ahead after you get sworn in January and you walk into that office, what is your first priority?
Well, of course, you know, I will be sworn in just as the legislature is convening, and we're going to have a lot of fresh faces in the legislature in January, and I'll be sure to be as supportive as I can be to the legislature and doing the work that they do and getting folks up to speed about, you know, what the Attorney General does and some of the issues that we are experts in. But of course, I have, particular pieces of legislation that I want to focus on. The first, of course, being legislation related to reproductive liberty. We've, thank goodness, Vermonters resoundingly passed the Reproductive Liberty Amendment. But there are things that I think we should be looking at, and I think the legislature already is looking at, to make sure that we're shoring up our laws and whatever policies we need to related to reproductive liberty for folks in state who may be providers of abortions and folks out of state who may be seeking abortions here.
I want to come back to that issue, but can I want to go to another personal issue, because I think about this a lot for all people who run for office, and that is the personal sacrifice that it takes, number one, and number two, the sheer act of putting yourself out there in such a public way when our national politics are so divided and so tribal and so filled with animosity, to put it nicely. It is not easy to put yourself out there in such a public way, walking out the door of your house, driving around the state, putting yourself out there at town meetings, or at a brewery, or a honking wave. That's not easy, and I think it's important that we talk about how hard it is. Talk about putting yourself out there in a public way, in a way that you had never done before.
You know, in some ways, we're lucky here in Vermont, as we are in so many issues, but we've all had that experience of putting ourselves out there. I think when we go to town meeting, even, or we're getting involved with our children's school, or just going to the grocery store. We live in these, you know, small communities. Even Burlington, which is obviously our largest city, is really a small community in the grand scheme of things. And so it feels like I'm just a member of my community, and now more people are getting to know me than previously. The one thing that is a little feels a little surprising, or took some adjusting, is just being out in the world and people knowing who I am, but I don't know who they are.
Right.
You know, normally you know people in your community and they know you. And this is like, you know, especially after I won the primary, I remember my dad and I were going on a hike that like the next day or something. And a couple people we passed said, you know, congratulations, Charity. And it was like, oh, wow, you know who I am, and I don't know who you are. So I'm looking forward to getting to know more people, too. So that's kind of a two-way street.
Well, unlike somebody like Dave Zuckerman, we know a lot about him because he's been a public figure for a long time. So give us a little bio. Tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you grew up in Vermont, et cetera.
Well, sure. You know, one thing that you referenced I didn't really address was how I seem to come from nowhere. And that's because so often our statewide elected officials previously held office, you know, especially in the legislature. And I would argue that for the Attorney General's office, the better experience would be the experience that I had, which is working in the Attorney General's office. We're not legislators. We don't pass laws. We support the legislature, but we're lawyers and we represent the state and all of its business. And so I, you know, after almost 8 years in the Attorney General's office, I would argue probably more experience than any attorney general in living memory had to come from the office. It's one of the things that makes me unique as a candidate. But I didn't have the same statewide platform that I might have had I been, you know, Speaker of the House or a previous, you know, statewide office holder, or even, you know, a state senator. So that is a unique thing that I kind of brought in my candidacy. So that's my immediate background, is working in the AG's office. But I did grow up in southern Vermont. I started out living in Ludlow, and then when I was seven, we moved to Manchester. So I sort of have kind of two hometowns, but I usually refer to Manchester as my hometown. I spent most of the time in my childhood there. And I always have to reference my family's grocery store because it made a big impression on me. I grew up working there, you know, stocking shelves, running the cash register. It was, it wasn't a small grocery store. Maybe it was a small supermarket. It's not huge, but it was in a small community and everyone knew each other. And I worked there like a lot, you know, starting from when I was 10 and really regularly starting when I was 13, and until my last day when I was in law school. And then from there, I went to UVM. At UVM, when you were talking, Kevin, you were making a lot of observations that I was thinking about. This one class made such an impression on me called voting behavior. And it was so fascinating. I was thinking about things I learned in that class last night about, you know, how, why do people vote and how they vote and even candidates, what makes a good candidate. It's really interesting stuff. And I worked for Governor Dean after I graduated. I always give this tip to UVM students I talk to. Do an internship, because I did an internship for Senator Leahy and for Governor Dean, and that's how I ended up working for Governor Dean. I worked there for over 4 years before I went to law school. And the thing about my adult life is Vermont kept calling me home. So I went to Boston for law school. I went to Boston College. And I came back afterwards, and I worked at Downs Racklin Martin, Vermont's largest law firm, which I loved. Then I moved to New York City, and I worked at a big law firm there for 6 years. And of course, Vermont called me home again. And I guess I'm just resigned. It's like the greatest place on earth. I'm not leaving again. It's the best. So I started working in 2014 at the AG's office.
That's a long road. That's a lot of experience. After we come back from this break, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of what the Attorney General's office does on a day-to-day basis. So stick with us if you have the time. If you have to go and make thank you calls and or get a nap, please, we won't hold it. We won't hold it against you.
You sensed my 3 hours of sleep. No, I'll be here. I'll wait.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to point out the reason we're couching our language is that you saying you're making history by being the first elected woman to be Attorney General is because Suzanne Young, the state's current Attorney General, is appointed to the post in June by Governor Phil Scott after your boss, T.J. Donovan, stepped down to work in the private sector. So we want to give Suzanne Young her props. She is the first female Attorney General in the state's history. Is that true?
Yes.
I think that's right. Yeah. No small feat in her own right. A great career. Charity, one more political question before we get to the job of the Attorney General. You won at this. Yeah, all the votes are in. Well, you've got one more precinct to report, but you received 177,853 votes. How many of those votes came from you shaking a hand? How many hands did you shake? How many people do you think you talked to?
I talked to a lot of people, but because I got such a late start, I had to use I relied on other means of communicating with folks because I just didn't have time, literally, you know, enough calendar days to shake hands and knock on doors. So I tried to use social media especially, and I was using tools to maximize the, like, eyeballs who were seeing what I was posting. And I also did, you know, mailings and media, other media. I tried to put an ad in every, you know, local paper and et cetera. So I wasn't able to sort of do, like, literally shake hands, as you say. I tried to get into communities, and, of course, I was fortunate to have a lot of support from folks who were in community. So I got a lot of endorsements. And I think for folks who maybe didn't get to meet me directly, to have someone in their community say, I'm voting for Charity Clark, here's why, she's great, whatever, I think maybe was helpful in getting my message out and showing support for my candidacy.
Okay, so let's switch gears to the job. What is the job? I think we all know that you're the top cop. So the way law enforcement is conducted in the state is your job, but there's also the job of being the lawyer for state government. So why don't you take us through what the job is?
Sure. You know, the top cop is it's pithy and it rhymes and it fits on a headline. But actually, in Vermont, we have 14 county prosecutors and the attorney general who have the same jurisdiction in terms of authority. It's just geographic scope that's different. So each county prosecutor, of course, has prosecution authority in their county, and the attorney general has the same authority except it's statewide. And so it's not really, we don't like oversee the county prosecutors, but known as the state's attorneys here. So I always want to clarify that a little bit. And really where I start when I describe what the AG does is to say the AG is the lawyer to the state. So that includes, you know, prosecuting criminal offenses, but but it also is prosecuting violations of environmental laws or consumer laws. Those would be most likely in civil court, not in criminal court, and just representing the state, even in things that you don't maybe think about as being, you know, the sexy headline grabbing kind of legal work. It might be reviewing a contract or advising a state body about, you know, the open meeting law or something like that. And there are 150 people working at the Attorney General's office, 90 of whom are attorneys. I would say 10% of those workers do criminal law and the others do something else. And it really runs the gamut. There's 7 divisions, and it's a wide variety. I'll highlight the one area where I think most Vermonters interface with the AG, and that is the Consumer Assistance Program. Right. The Consumer Assistance Program is that, you know, office you call if you got scammed or if you have a consumer concern, you're having a fight with a business, or you maybe are a small business and you're having a problem. You would contact the Consumer Assistance Program, which receives 15,000 contacts every year with Vermonters and 5,000 scam calls. So you can see it really touches a lot of Vermonters.
Yeah, it's for those of you out there wondering what that means, that's the robocall you're getting from somebody posing as the IRS telling you that you have to call them immediately or you're going to jail, and they're trying to separate you from your money. And this is what that's what the consumer office at the Attorney General's does as among other things.
Yep.
It seems like I'm getting 10 of those calls a day now.
I know. It's really hard. A lot of what they do is they educate folks because, you know, not everyone is as savvy or they're just, you know, I always say that scammers try to spike your emotional response. So once that happens, it's hard to get out of it. If they're saying, you know, lying and saying they're your grandson and they need you to wire money to them, it's so tempting to just feel anxious and worried and want to do the thing. I mean, so they do a lot of education and outreach as well.
There is the case. You have to get along with and work closely together with county prosecutors. One of those is the Chittenden State's Attorney Sarah George, who is a noted law enforcement reformer, criminal justice reformer, and she's run into some conflict with both the governor and your former boss, T.J. Donovan. How do you see going forward with her? Are you aligned? Do you have disagreements? Are you going to sit down together and map out how you can work together in Chittenden County with all the concerns about uptick in crime in Burlington and the recent shootings, et cetera?
Well, my goal is to have a collegial, healthy working relationship with all of the county prosecutors. I was really fortunate as chief of staff. I oversaw our expungement clinics, which we partnered with the state attorneys on. And so I worked with almost all of them, I think, by the time I left the office. And, look forward to, as you say, getting together, meeting with the state attorneys and making sure that we're communicating well and also discussing the reforms that we, many state attorneys share the feeling that it's time for reform in our criminal justice system. It really, I agree, it doesn't really align neatly with the values that we have here. I think there's some outdated elements of our criminal justice system. There are systemic racism issues that need to be addressed and rectified. One of the issues I campaigned on was reforming or continuing to reform really our sealing and expungement process. And I think the state's attorneys agree on that. So that'll be something that we'll work on in January. And I'm sure other items will come up. It's really important that we maintain that sort of, Vermont mindset of, working with others and having that collegial atmosphere. And I'll look forward to continuing to bring that to the relationships that the Attorney General's office has with the state's attorney.
We just passed a reproductive rights amendment in overwhelming fashion. I do not have the amendment in front of me. Where will you intersect with that reproductive rights amendment in the Constitution? Will you have to defend it Do you anticipate it being challenged at any, in any way?
I'll just start by saying how excited I am, Kevin, because honestly, when the Dobbs decision came down, it was so demoralizing as a woman. I'm sure many people in Vermont felt this way, but you know, really what it felt like was the United States Supreme Court was telling me, you are less of a human being than men. Not to be recognized as an independent human in charge of my own body, and to have voters vote yes on Article 22 was so reaffirming of saying, you know what, the United States Constitution doesn't see me that way, but my fellow Vermonters see me that way. And to have everybody show up so resoundingly, it's just can't emphasize enough how happy I was to see that so quickly be resolved last night and know where Vermonters stood. In terms of the Attorney General's role, the Attorney General defends lawsuits against the state. And, you know, we don't get to pick those lawsuits. That's just part of our job. That's what we sign up for if you are Attorney General, and absolutely would look forward to defending that lawsuit, in part because I know the language was crafted so carefully by the best constitutional minds of our state. I'm very confident in the language and would look forward to defending any lawsuit should it come up.
Well, that amendment won 285,000 votes, 72% to 22% against, a resounding victory. So that message is pretty clear. Charity Clark, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on your victory. Charity Clark, the first elected attorney general elect in the state of Vermont's history. Go have a well-deserved nap, and we will look forward to seeing you inaugurated in January. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Okay.
Take care.
So a page of history has turned. Becca Ballant is elected as the first woman to represent Vermont in Congress, and Charity Clark, the first woman to be the elected Attorney General of the state of Vermont. David Zuckerman, our middle guest, back in the Lieutenant Governor's office. Phil Scott winning a resounding fourth term, proving that he is well-liked, well-known, and highly skilled. It's a testament to Phil and his team, and we look forward to having him on in the near future. I'm in conversation with them, and they have an open invitation to come on whenever he would like. Fred from Newberry, we're not going to take your call on this side of the break. I will take you first out of the box on the other side of this break. We're going to go to CBS News because we've got to find out what's going on nationally with that Nevada race, because that looks like that's determining who's going to control the United States Senate. So hang on, Fred. I'm Kevin Ellis. It's Vermont Viewpoint. You're listening to WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back. So we're going to go open phones, and in studio is Miles Rimmel from Manchester. U.S. Senate candidate, didn't win, but we've got we need his perspective on this because we need to understand how the red tidal wave didn't happen. But before we do, Fred from Newberry has been waiting patiently. Fred, you're on the air. How are you?
Good morning. Hey. Yeah, I was going to talk to the Attorney General, but anyways, you can handle it just as well. Back in my early early days, I was in the restaurant service business, and there were a lot of people from Eastern Europe and South America and Africa and just about everywhere in the world, and they were living in this country, and they were doing, a lot of them owned restaurants. And so anyways, my question was, when you were living in your home country, you had a thought and a dream and a perception of what America was all about. Then you've been here now for, you know, 5-10 years. What is the thing that stands out most in your mind about America? And you won't believe what they said. They told me, I bet 85% of them and 95% of them said, there's no corruption in America. That's what is so special about this country.
And guess what? Yeah.
There is no corruption in this country. It has to be no good. This country couldn't live without corruption. When I was in the Army back 55 years ago, thanks, pay was done in cash, 5s, 10s, and 20s. And it was all done in cash, and nobody wanted a cut of that cash that had a higher grade than I did. That was, you know, proof to me.
You know, Fred, Fred, you're raising an interesting point. You asked the question, what it means to be American. I was going to say freedom, but the lack of corruption. Look, we all complain about corruption and waste and fraud and abuse in our federal government, but compared to other countries, I was on a bus from Montpelier to Burlington yesterday next to a young man from Nepal who's a freshman at Norwich University, and I did a double take, and I said, what would a young man from Nepal be doing at Norwich University, a civilian slash military college? And he said, full scholarship, America. That's what I'm doing here. And you raise a good point. Day after Election Day, I mean, you know, what do you think about this? I mean, one word, American. What's it mean to be an American?
Capitalist system combined with free markets and freedom of conscience.
Yeah. So thanks, Fred, for the call. Okay, so let's go from there to the national map. We are not a red wave. Not sure what the reason for that is, but candidates that could have won. I'm thinking of New Hampshire. I'm thinking there could have been a red wave had. I'll make this statement, and then you let me bounce it off you. If Trump had not weighed in and pushed candidates like Carrie Lake, Bolduc in New Hampshire, Dr. Oz, Herschel Walker, and there's a fourth that I'm missing, you could have seen a dramatic change in the United States Senate. If the governor of New Hampshire had run for the United States Senate and beaten Maggie Hassan, you're looking at big change.
I'm not sure that's exactly true.
I mean,
the President Trump did support a number of moderates, Mehmet Oz among them, right? J.D. Vance among them. In Pennsylvania, he had a very strong conservative kind of Republican dream opponent in David McCormick. Princeton PhD, Bronze Star, hedge fund, billionaire, well, not billionaire, but multimillionaire, centimillionaire. And Trump picked Oz, right? He picked the more moderate candidate, like he picked J.D. Vance. And also in Pennsylvania, it was kind of a, if you remember originally, the original endorsement was too far right. So he is the leader of our party. I'm not sure that he deserves the blame for the losses that were taken. I think there's something deeper what's happening across the country, and you can see it in the gubernatorial elections. Some of the Republican wins that should have been chalked up don't look like they're happening. Like Carrie Lake, who, if she had won, doesn't look like she's going to win, you know, whether there was issues with the Maricopa voting system, I'm sure we'll hear about. But or the county system, but she didn't win. She lost to Katie Hobbs.
I'm shocked
and
by that.
Mastriano, mega MAGA candidate, right, lost handily to Josh Shapiro. Stacey Abrams, however, did not prevail against Brian Kemp. But, you know, there are other races out there like Tony Evers in Wisconsin who pulled it off. Also in Kansas, Laura Kelly, a Democrat, pulled it off. So there are a number of these are important seats. The Republicans have been focusing on gubernatorial seats for the past 30 years.
Yeah.
Right. And these are important seats that really control a lot of what happens, a lot of the money in the states, and a lot of the Republic. So the fact that the Democrats were picking these up points to something deeper that's happening across the country.
I was shocked by the Katie Hobbs, Carrie Lake race, because Katie Hobbs, in my view, she had been a highly regarded Secretary of State, rocketed to fame in defending the election results against Trump allegations. But she declined to debate Carrie Lake in that race, which I thought was just political malpractice at every level. And yet she wins. So I'm wrong and she was right. But I'm shocked by that race.
I know a number of commentators have talked about this idea that, you know, candidates are running without debating. And there almost wasn't a debate in the race with Fetterman and Oz.
Yeah.
And I think the people deserve to see a debate.
Yeah.
Right. And we should all insist on debates, whatever side we're on.
And my personal view is we got to figure out a way to do debates that are not so scripted and tightly structured so that we can't learn who these people are.
Well, we could start with having a Republican moderator.
Oh, gosh, I love it. This is the
bring on Gwen Ifill again. Okay. Yeah, all right. But, for national –
Gwen Ifill is not a down-the-middle
really
moderator?
Able to, you know, even Megyn Kelly, who's now founder –
yeah.
Whatever Zoom in the podosphere.
Whatever podosphere,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she, you know, remember she just ripped the face off President Trump in that first debate with her question. So
Candy Crowley telling Mitt Romney that he was wrong about something when he debated
Republicans always wrong.
When he debated Obama.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're wrong, Mr.
Yeah, you're
Romney.
Wrong. You're wrong. You horrible people.
Where are we nationally? It's pretty clear that the Republicans are going to take the House, even though we don't have the final results.
Yeah, they'll probably be up five seats, right? McCarthy will take over. And then some of the issues are, you know, as Lieutenant Governor Zuckerman brought up, can you pull some of those five over? Can you intimidate them? And can you blame them from the coming recession? Right, because the fist bump deal with MBS in Saudi Arabia is over. The strategic oil reserve is depleted. Gas prices are going up. It's going to be a cold winter in New England. And some of these climate policies are going to produce suffering and misery. Right? And who's going to get the blame? The Republicans, right? Because they're the obstructionists.
Right?
Can they pull some of the Republicans over? Will some of the Republicans all of a sudden become red Joe Manchins, you know, trying to, you know, figure out which way the wind is blowing? Who knows? I mean, it's going to be very interesting because we're not going to have the tiebreaker vote in the Senate, right? And so, but a lot of the legislative.
Did you just say you're a Republican? There's no scenario under which.
I don't think so.
No, that's right. Obviously, because you don't have the vice president.
Yeah, we don't have. Right. So even if we're 50-50, we lose. So I think that's as good as we can get. It's unclear where we'll get to Georgia. And, you know, Fulton County's not going to get pastored of 50%. You know, if it's below 50%, it's a runoff. But he's pretty close. I thought he was 49-4 before.
But Adam Laxalt's going to win in Nevada.
Yes, he is. Yeah, but his father and grandfather were senators too, so it's not like he doesn't have name ID.
But
that was a flip. But you also flipped PA on us.
Right.
Right, so it was a flip back and forth. So that's really not dispositive or, you know, predictive.
What does this mean for – go ahead.
Well, I didn't mean to, you know, anthropomorphize you as the Democrat Party. It's just because you don't have a tie on.
Oh, this is going to be fun. I got to say, Myers is here. He's got a tie on. He's got the Tom Brady zip up. He's got the blue blazer.
Oh, yeah.
He's got three sharpened pencils.
It's Western civilization.
You know, the Ivy League is sitting across from my
Oh, please.
You ran for lieutenant governor in New York State.
I did.
When you lived over there in 2012.
Yep. I had support out of 45 out of 62 counties, which were all the rural counties, which are very much like Vermont. But as you know, my fourth great grandfather was a Green Mountain boy in the state of Vermont.
How do you explain Kathy Hochul winning the governorship over there despite $11 million from Ronald Lauder for his opponent in the waning days?
Now you're condemning us for a mere $11 million? Please.
In a state where legality fuzzy term.
Well, you know, she has her base in Erie County. And so the
Buffalo.
The major power centers in New York State are on the western edge with Erie and then in Long Island and also in the city. It doesn't look like Lee was able to pull the numbers he needed in the city. She had a lot of strength in the city, which is not what you'd expect, right? You'd expect crime would be more important to people in the city. If you listen to WABC and Katzmatidis, and right. I mean, they continue with this narrative that crime is, and frankly, anecdotally, people you talk to don't want to ride the subways. They don't feel safe. But that didn't seem to stop anybody voting for her. And I heard Doug Schoen say that, well, you know, the Democrats will fix it. And there are some people that are saying, yes, inflation's a problem. Yes, crime is a problem. But they didn't trust the Republicans to fix it.
Interesting. Okay. Right. We're off the air and we were talking about the Vermont House. So this is going to be an under talked about story. The Speaker of the House, Jill Kerwinski in Vermont, the representative from Burlington, now has under her control, I use that term loosely, 109 seats out of 150 seat body. Boy, you talk about Kevin McCarthy. If the Republicans take over the U.S. House, the dog caught the car with Kevin McCarthy. He's going to have problems on his hand. Jill Kerwinski, when you have 109 people, you talk about herding cats. I've seen that up close, and that is really, really hard. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, it looks as if the Republicans were at 46 before the election, and then today they're somewhere around 38. There was one vacancy, so we're down 9. Certainly we didn't get the veto-proof block that we wanted.
Right.
Right. And so that's going to be an issue. I would imagine that the Democrats and progressives following in the wake of Ms. Ballant would double down. Right. And so we're going to look at Prop 2, which was a slavery amendment, which I've heard people say invalidates incarceration or working in prisons, which I don't remember that being discussed before. And then some of the other issues that might come up are qualified immunity. Vermont Law School, the home of restorative justice, is due with their report in the next month. So qualified immunity is...
Qualified
immunity is the legal doctrine that protects public servants, including the police, from lawsuits. But if that were to be removed, as it has been in a limited sense from some other states, then our police could be subject to any number of lawsuits, which would cost $25,000 to $50,000 to defend, even if they were innocent. So you could imagine that people would come in and back plaintiffs that would just sue the police. The Vermont Chiefs of Police Association has publicly stated they think they're going to lose half of the force if qualified immunity is removed. So this was something that was kicked down the can, but with this larger majority, you know, the question is that really is defunding, right? Whether you call it defunding or not, when you force 50% of the police to leave. That's going to cause real problems. But if you've normalized crime, right, I heard from the Democrats in the races over the summer that crime happens. Don't worry about it. And your touchstone, Ms. Sarah Fair George, right, won against a primary opponent. Why there wasn't a Republican attorney running against her, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think we have some Republican attorneys in this state, I've been told.
Hold that thought. The phones are lighting up.
Lighting up.
So we got to go to Jim from Barry. You're on the phone with Kevin and Myers from Mermel.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
I just kind of jumped in here in the conversation, so I don't know exactly everything that's been said, and I haven't had a chance to analyze all the national results yet myself. But I'm kind of wondering if my theory is somewhat right. It seems like the results are all over the place. And there's no single clear track. So I'm wondering if maybe that clear common denominator is the way I would have voted. I'm Republican. and I, you know, kind of a Ronald Reagan Republican, Phil Scott Republican. But I nationally, I wouldn't have, we didn't have any choices in Vermont on this, but nationally I wouldn't have voted for anyone that was an election denier or was endorsed by Trump. I think we need to put that behind us. So I'm wondering, if is that the common denominator? How many people that were endorsed by Trump won, and how many people that were election deniers won?
Good question.
Or lost?
Good question, Jim. Thanks for the call. What do you think, Mars?
I'm still wrapping my head around being a Phil Scott Republican and a Ronald Reagan Republican. God bless you.
But yeah, that's the genius of Phil Scott.
But right, I heard there, a Massachusetts accent. Are you from Vermont, or are you a person that moved here?
Oh, he's gone.
He's gone.
We dropped him. That was a Massachusetts accent.
Well, okay. There's nothing wrong
for
with
sure.
that.
For sure. For sure.
Well, no, but I mean, he's kind of squared the circle. The question is, you know, what does this mean for the Republican Party? Right. And so, of course, there'll be a lot of recriminations, and, you know, politics always look for a scapegoat or somebody to blame. So, you know, does the party or the process or individuals get blamed? Who knows?
Gary from Montpelier, you are on the line with Myers and Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Kevin. How's it going, man?
Good.
Good to talk to you. Very interesting show. First of all, I thought that I heard your guest in reference to Carrie Lake make a reference to, you know, oh, we don't know why she lost. You know, maybe it was election irregularities or whatever. And I would just say, just please don't go there with that. We've had enough of that stuff. You know, when my kid was little and she played on the basketball team and she was like 8, she was coming home from a game they lost and she was like, the refs cheated us. And I said, don't even start with that. So to me, that's just like a total non-starter. You know, I'm encouraged, I guess, a little by the results from last night. You know, I'm a Democrat, I guess, or an independent, but I vote Democrat. However, it's really troubling to me that, like, the Senate is now, you know, hanging in the balance because we can't beat Herschel Walker. You know, Carrie Lake in Arizona lost because her campaign was completely detached from reality. And many Republican campaigns, that the kind of MAGA brand is completely detached from reality. But I'm very concerned that Democrats can't beat those people. You know, DeSantis is coming in 2024, and we got to get our game up.
Well, the DeSantis Trump tarantulas in a bottle for the next few months is going to be really interesting. So, Gary, thanks for the call. We're running out of time. Final thoughts, Myers.
Final, Gary. I'm sorry that you heard that. I wasn't pointing. I wasn't blaming the ref. I'm just saying that I think that may be brought up. As you know, Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, Stacey Abrams, Donald Trump have all disputed the elections. That it's part of our process now. I'm sure people will dispute results. I'm not in favor of that, and I think I've been calling it pretty clear. But to the point that you made, it seems like things are a little muddled at the time because as we've gotten more divided, things have just gotten closer, and one side isn't winning. The needle's just moving slightly from left to right.
Well, as I've said before, it's serious issues for serious people, and we're going to have these serious discussions right here on Vermont Viewpoint. Myers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it. I'm going to be on a break next week, so as well as Friday. So you're going to be without me. There will be substitute hosts, and I apologize for that. But vacation has been is now a requirement for me. So I'll miss you all. I'll miss your calls. I'll miss this discussion. I'm loving it, and I'll be back after next week. This has been one heck of an election, and I think the headline is, no red wave. It's a red ripple, but there's a lot of surprises out there. I guess I would leave us all with one lesson, and that is good candidates win if they run good campaigns. Bad candidates lose. It's not always the case, but voters can still recognize good candidates from bad ones, and we'll see where that takes us. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you when I get back. This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis. We'll be back soon with more great guests, more great discussion, and you're listening to WDEV.